It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Recent attacks by ISIS elements on a Russian airliner, Lebanon, and Paris suggest ISIS has changed its strategy from focusing on the insurgency in Iraq and Syria to engaging in global terrorism. But is this accurate? Terrorism expert and associate professor of international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, Michael Kenney, joins us to discuss ISIS and ways to stop them. Michael Kenney, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
And you can join the conversation with your comments and questions at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. We know that terrorism is something that we can't help thinking about and that you have questions you'd like to ask, concerns you'd like to express. We'd like to hear from you. 412-246-2002 is the number to call to join the conversation. Michael Kenney, let's start with the question of whether ISIS has changed its strategy from focusing on the insurgency in Iraq and Syria to engaging in global terrorism. Is this accurate?
Well, what's changed over the last several weeks has been three separate incidents, which you referred to at the beginning, the one in Egypt against the Russian airliner, the one in Lebanon a week before Paris, and then the Paris attacks themselves. Interestingly, this was not the first time that ISIS had called for terrorist attacks against the West and against countries outside of Iraq and Syria. In fact, going all the way back to the summer and fall of 2014, the main ISIS spokesman, Muhammad al-Adnani, had called for attacks in the West. He basically issued two dictums to ISIS sympathizers throughout the world. His first point was, come join us. Make Hijra, immigrate to the Islamic State, and participate in our global effort here to build the caliphate. But if you can't do that, then your second priority should be to carry out attacks on the West. In the weeks and months after he issued that statement, there were a number of incidents, both plots that were disrupted by authorities and attacks in the West, including in the U.S., Canada. But these were all essentially low-level attacks involving lone wolves, individuals that sympathized with the ISIS call and used very low technology, knives to target different people, again, in Australia, Canada, even the U.S. What was different about Paris was it involved more perpetrators, it was better organized, there were teams of attackers, and they apparently received more direction from what could be called ISIS Central, based in Syria and Iraq. And a number of the perpetrators were apparently trained, received some sort of military training in Iraq and Syria. And because of all that, they were able to inflict a scale of lethality that was much greater than we saw with the earliest ISIS sympathizer lone wolf attacks. So that's what's different.
And did the president underestimate ISIS? You know, did he not realize that they might be more sophisticated than was originally thought? I mean, he's the one who called them the JV squad.
Yeah, I think looking back, the Obama administration probably would like to take some of those terms back. I think the intelligence agencies had a pretty good handle on the ISIS phenomena as it evolved over time. The Obama administration has been accused of downplaying ISIS at times. Calling it a JV squad was probably not the best use of terminology.
So what are the common themes in the backgrounds of the perpetrators, the people behind this? What are we learning about them as this goes on?
So an important point about the Paris attacks was it involved a lot of foreign fighters. What do I mean by foreign fighters? These are essentially angry, alienated, primarily young men from different European countries that radicalized into a very extreme, fundamentalist, literalist, violent-laden interpretation of Scripture decided to go over to Iraq and Syria and participate in this project, building the caliphate, receive some training, and then later return to their home countries, and in this case, were able to carry out some devastating attacks. So what we're seeing among many of the perpetrators in the Paris attack, angry, alienated, young, suffering from integration problems in Europe. They weren't necessarily poor. Some of them came from a middle class or working class background. Several had been involved in criminal behavior, essentially petty crime. Some of them were imprisoned for that, and some of them even met in prison. A number of them spent time in the Molenbeek neighborhood of Belgium, which is that was important because it was there they were able to network with other criminals, get access to weapons. And unfortunately, a number of these perpetrators of the Paris attacks were known to the intelligence agencies. They had been identified for surveillance, but because of resource constraints, the intelligence agencies were not in Europe, were not able to keep tabs on them the way they, in retrospect, probably should have.
Is that going to change?
Well, France has announced, you know, a new initiative. They're going to be spending several hundred million dollars to try and keep track of these people. But it's important for us to remember that France and Belgium in particular are dealing with the scale of a problem that we don't have here yet, at least yet, thankfully, in the U.S. They're literally dealing with thousands and thousands of these angry, young, alienated people that are getting radicalized into this interpretation. So for them, they really are struggling to keep up with the magnitude of that threat.
How could and how can European nations like Belgium have handled this better in terms of making Muslims less disenfranchised? Do they need to focus on that now?
Well, I think one effort that they've already been working on, but I think that they now realize they need to increase, which is sometimes called countering the narrative. The idea with countering the narrative is we're not going to be able to arrest our way out of the problem. We're not going to be able to bomb our way out of the problem. We have to recognize that in addition to being a military struggle, this is a war of ideas. And we have to reach out to the young men and women that are vulnerable to this extremist interpretation and try to counter the narrative that they're receiving literally around the clock on the internet from ISIS.
And so are we talking about people all around the world? Because we hear, for example, CBS, I saw a story that they did last week where they went back to Minneapolis. Minneapolis seems to be the place where, because of Somali refugees and others who have a Muslim background, that seems to be the place where many are buying into this narrative and traveling to wherever they need to go to be trained and get involved. Some are being caught, but some are not.
Yeah, in the case of Minneapolis, I would just add the caveat that when we use a term like many, we're really only talking about, in reality, a small number of people that are getting radicalized when you look at it in the totality of the larger communities from which they come. But unfortunately, the number has been big enough that a number of young men, whether it's from Minneapolis or from Belgium or France, have, been able to go over, whether it was to Somalia or more recently to Syria and Iraq. It is a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, ISIS is reaching out to angry young men across Europe, the United States, Australia. They have people working on this 24 hours a day.
And what about foreign fighters and the problem of blowback, as it's called? How big of a problem is this?
I think it's a bigger problem in Europe than it is in the United States.
And describe what it is.
Okay, so first, what is it? So the foreign fighter blowback problem refers to when you have these angry young men and women from the West that decide to go to an active theater, Syria and Iraq, participate in the fighting, gain some technological knowledge and skill, and they decide to return back to their, so they're foreign fighters in Iraq and Syria, they decide to return to their home countries, and the blowback part kicks in when, in some of those cases, historically it's around 10% of returning fighters decide to engage in political violence within their home countries. So then the foreign fighter problem becomes blowback, because the idea is it's an unintended consequence of their experience of having gone overseas, trained, and then come back, and then they try to engage in political violence in their home countries.
Where are they successfully? Where are would-be young terrorists? Where are they going? Is it happening here? Is it happening in Europe?
It's in terms of the scale of the problem, it's much greater in Europe than it is, thankfully, in the United States. For example, France has estimates of young men and women that have gone there, anywhere from 1,200 to 1,500, making it the single largest supplier of a European country of foreign fighters to Iraq and Syria. Britain has estimates with Britain around 750. Belgium has around 500, has sent around 550, which in absolute terms might be small, but Belgium, let's remember, is a very small country, only 11 million people. So Belgium is actually the largest per capita supplier of foreign fighters to Iraq and Syria. In comparison to those three examples, the U.S. Estimates here anywhere from about 100 to 200 foreign fighters. So it's a problem here. It's not saying it's not a problem. Countering the narrative is something that we need to work on in the United States as well. But let's put it in perspective. Let's keep in mind that the scale of the problem that we're dealing with in the United States is much lower than what our friends and colleagues across the pond are dealing with.
And is that because we're tracking them better, or are we doing something differently than other countries are?
Some people believe that one reason why we're seeing less of a problem here has to do with the greater success we have in integrating immigrants into American society. Europe has some serious integration problems with its immigrants. Immigrants coming from North Africa, Morocco, Algeria, and elsewhere. Many of these folks, they're living in really poor areas. They don't receive the same level of social services from the government. They feel stigmatized. The U.S., and this is to our credit, we've done a better job integrating immigrants from other countries into the United States. People can participate and, you know, learn the language, get jobs, and become productive citizens, productive taxpaying citizens. So a lot of folks feel that we've just done a better job of integrating people, and this is perhaps one reason why we're seeing a smaller scale problem here.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with University of Pittsburgh Associate Professor of International Affairs and terrorism expert Michael Kenney, who is with us in studio, talking about ISIS, ways to stop them, immigration, screening of refugees, vetting of refugees, and all that goes with that. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh at wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Of course, you know, we all worry about terrorists attacking the U.S. to the point where here in Pittsburgh, Mayor Peduto is being heavily criticized and even threatened because he wants to allow 500 Syrian refugees into Pittsburgh. And we talked before this interview, you and I, Michael, and you mentioned the idea of countering the narrative, which you just explained. But there's also the narrative that exists here in the United States, and some Republican presidential candidates are creating a narrative that the idea of allowing refugees in to the United States poses an incredible danger to us. Tom Brokaw over the weekend criticized Donald Trump, came straight out and called him a liar. We'll get into some of that. But with regard to the problems that our own mayor is having here in Pittsburgh with the idea of 500 refugees, Syrian refugees, which he is not saying he's absolutely steadfast in doing. He's not going to change his mind about it. What about it? And what about the fears that people have? Are they in any way founded?
Well, of course. I mean, people are understandably concerned about this issue, given what happened in the Paris attacks and the incident within that set of attacks
but
that occurred.
No, I understand what you're saying, but this was before the attacks. The people were already
that's true.
Heavily criticizing the mayor online and in all sorts of ways, and it may have gotten more serious after Paris. That may have been when the threats to the mayor started coming in, and
right.
and the police chief, Cameron McLay, said, we need to give you protection. But that having been said, this resistance began before the attacks on Friday the 13th. So, you know, what are the truths? What are the myths? What are the things that we need to think about rationally without reacting in terms of knee-jerk fear?
Okay. I think one thing for us to think about with respect to this problem is just remembering that Syrian refugees face, that participate in the resettlement policy to the United States, face the most rigorous screening of just about anyone entering the U.S. It's not like they're accepted into the program one day and a few weeks later they're flown over here. That's just not how it works.
How does it work?
They undergo multiple screenings, multiple background checks and interviews with different U.S. government agencies. They get their fingerprints taken several different times. They're subjected to different interviews with different U.S. government agencies as well as United Nations agencies. This whole process, Paul, takes anywhere from 2 to 3 years. And during that time, it's not like all these interviews are just done at the beginning and then nothing happens. This takes place throughout the process. In fact, the final interviews are done after they're accepted in. So they go, there's this very rigorous process that people go through. And I think that's one reason why, although thousands of Syrians have come to the United States since 2011 through this program, not a single one of them has been arrested or removed from the United States on terrorism charges. And I think it speaks to the strength and the rigor of the resettlement policy as it stands.
So why aren't people hearing that? Why are people thinking that, you know, when they hear Donald Trump say, we're going to create a, you know, if he becomes president, he wants to create a database for Syrian refugees and put mosques under surveillance. And you're putting your hand to your forehead, you know, like with a reaction that speaks volumes. But people are, you know, aren't coming right out and saying this is a bad idea. Some are, but there are those who believe, and the polls show this, that what Donald Trump is advocating seems like a good idea. So evidently they're not hearing the statistics that you just cited.
Well, let me be clear. In my opinion, what candidate Donald Trump proposing would be a very bad idea. It would be completely counterproductive. Basically, what he's doing is playing to the politics of fear. And this is something that happens a lot in the immediate aftermath of particularly devastating terrorist attacks.
So how do you reassure people? You know, well, what you just said is pretty reassuring, but what needs to get out there to people that they apparently are just not hearing?
I would encourage people to go for themselves. Go Google the U.S. resettlement policy. Look into it yourself. Take a look at the facts, the statistics. They're out there. They're available. And I think if people were to do that, they keep an open mind about what they're looking at, I think they're going to see pretty quickly that this situation, there's a lot of hyperbole around, a lot of exaggeration around it right now.
We're talking with terrorism expert, University of Pittsburgh Professor Michael Kenney, talking about ISIS, ways to stop them. We'll get into issues of is the U.S. and would a city like Pittsburgh be vulnerable to a Paris-style attack? We'll get to your tweets and your phone calls, 412-246-2002. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about terrorism. We're talking about ISIS. We know you're thinking about it. We know you're concerned about it. We're trying to get to the truth about what exactly is behind ISIS. Who are the individuals who make it up? Who should accept some responsibility for this group's growing reach and sophistication? And what is the best way to counter them? 412-246-2002 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation with our guest, Michael Kenny. He's a University of Pittsburgh professor of international affairs and a terrorism expert. Again, to join the conversation with a comment or a question, 412-246-2002. Email esspgh at wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. And David on Twitter asks, Is ISIS a Sunni awakening versus Shiites? Michael Kenny, what do you think?
Is ISIS a Sunni awakening versus Shia? Okay. ISIS, they are Sunnis, and they hate Shias. And so many of their attacks are directed towards Shia Muslims. So the recent attack in Lebanon was directed by ISIS. They were trying to strike Hezbollah's main area of support inside of Lebanon. So there is I think what the tweeter is getting at is the sectarian dimensions of this struggle. And it is very much, there's a lot of sectarianism going on in there. And so ISIS represents the Sunni side. One of the groups they're fighting against in Syria, the Bashar al-Assad regime, they are supported by Hezbollah and other Shia groups. And Russia also supports that side of the conflict as well, whereas we're on the other side with our support of like the Free Syrian Army and other Sunni groups. There's a whole sectarian dimension here.
We have lots of callers on the line at 412-246-2002. We'll get to all of you, starting with Kelly in Pittsburgh. Kelly, welcome. You're on with Michael Kenny.
Hi. I live in Bloomfield, which is Italian and Polish and Irish. It's all around us. All these different immigrants have, came here and came here under very difficult scenarios. And I just think that if we're going to, have love in our hearts and believe in good, I applaud the mayor for taking this difficult situation. And my comment on how to resolve the issue might seem far-fetched, but I really believe that a lot of these things are driven by money and trillion-dollar wars, and that we need to say before we go to war again that we would have a draft. And that would cause the politicians to really, really have to be accountable to people on why we're sending, our sons and daughters off to fight these wars and die for these wars.
Kelly, I appreciate your sentiments and what you're saying. I'm not sure about whether if we did send troops into Syria, whether there would need to be a draft. Michael?
I appreciate Kelly's comment and question. I think the first part of her comment I found to be particularly helpful. And this idea that, one of the things that has made the United States the great country that it is, it has historically been our take on immigration, and that we have opened our arms to people from other countries to be able to come here, sometimes in very difficult circumstances, and to remake their lives.
Hasn't this happened before? Haven't we traditionally, at times like these, certainly during World War II and after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were sent to internment camps. Haven't we always... there's a history here of the U.S. just reacting in, for lack of a better word, stupid ways to threats to our safety.
Well, yeah, there's also examples of that. You mentioned the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Thousands upon thousands of these people put in essentially prisoner of war camps. After 9/11, let's not forget, thousands of people were rounded up by law enforcement agencies. We were very concerned about the potential for follow-up attacks. So we cast the net very widely and rounded up a lot of people that had absolutely nothing to do with terrorism.
And on the other hand, people are afraid.
Right.
Understandably so. Yeah. And there was reportedly a Syrian refugee who got into Europe and who might have been involved in the attacks in Paris, who never raised any red flags. He apparently was vetted but got through anyway. So there's that fear.
There is that fear, and it's an understandable fear. But at the same time, if we completely give in to our fears, we let the bad guys win. Remember, this is how terrorism works. The power of terrorism is that it seeks to shock us and overwhelm us and provoke this sort of emotional response. And one aspect of that emotional response that they're looking to instigate is our fear and the hope that our politics will be driven by our fears so that we overreact and do policies that in the long term are counterproductive.
Let's go to Jim on the South Side. Jim, you're on with Michael Kenney. Welcome.
I had a question. I guess this kind of repeats to some extent the question about the Sunni revival. But my question has to do with, there's basically three major power players in the Middle East. There's Iran, there's Saudi Arabia, and there's Israel. Why do we see ISIS focusing so much on the Iran proxies and like Assad and Beirut and things like that? Why don't we see, for instance, ISIS doesn't seem to be facing Israel with the same kinds of threats that they're doing in Beirut and in Syria?
Okay.
Jim, thank you. So how would you answer Jim's question?
Well, I think it's an excellent question, very thoughtful. And what I like about it is I do feel that U.S. policy, we become obsessed with trying to oust Bashar al-Assad. Okay, I'm not trying to downplay Bashar al-Assad. He is an incredibly brutal ruler that has just been horrible, has murdered thousands upon thousands of his own citizens. But I think we need to realize here, we do have a common enemy, which is ISIS. And I do believe that ISIS represents a threat that the United States needs to take seriously, that we do take seriously. But I think in terms of our Syria policy, we would be a little more effective if we can come together with the French and even the Russians and focus more on our common enemy at this point, which is ISIS.
Let's go to, before we go to Joe and Hopewell, let's go to Terry from Regent Square. He's not there, but he had an interesting question, which I wanted to bring up anyway. So, Terry, thank you for suggesting this. He says, Caucasian men are statistically more likely to commit acts of terrorism. And you're aware of, I think he's referring to domestic attacks.
Okay.
And I think you're aware of this, Michael.
Well, so what
as a terrorism expert.
What we've seen since 9/11, for example, in the United States, so we're talking about domestic terrorism, okay? Since 9/11, more people have been killed in domestic terrorist attacks by white supremacists, sovereign citizens, these sorts of radicals than they have been by so-called Islamist terrorists. And many of the perpetrators behind white supremacists, sovereign citizens, many of those happen to be white males.
All right, now on to Joe from Hopewell. Hi, Joe. You're on the air. You're on Essential Pittsburgh with Michael Kenney.
Yeah, excellent program. I agree. I think no one understands the United States vets these refugees very closely, and Mayor Petuo and President Obama is correct in what they're doing. What I don't understand is TV in Hollywood makes all terrorists look like they're very clever, smart, and diabolical evil, but in reality, they're not as smart as people think. That's why they get caught eventually and after. My question to you, though, what scares me is I am worried about the rise of right-wing politics, not just here but in Europe, using these anti-immigration policies as a way to gain political power that could result into what we saw in the 30s. And I would like to see if the professor could talk about that. If an attack did happen here, I think there would be political repercussions and not so much in reality, because I think we do watch our borders. I think we have done a fantastic job in protecting American people from ISIS and groups like that.
Well, Joe, I appreciate that comment. And Michael, What if the United States were, what if New York City, say, or perhaps Pittsburgh, were subjected to an attack like the one that just happened in Paris? I know this is purely conjecture, but right. What would the reaction be?
Well, one of the first reactions would be probably that people like me are vilified because, you know, here you are, you come on a central Pittsburgh and you're trying to help us put the threat in perspective and then something happens. I mean, it's kind of the classic problem that we face with these. These are devastating attacks that kill and hurt a lot of people. Again, an important part of responding to this is the idea of community resilience. You know, like as the Brits put, you know, keep calm and carry on. You know, it's an important element here, and we don't want to lose that, because if something awful happens, yes, the potential for backlash, like the caller points out, I think he's absolutely right about that. So we do have to be careful of this.
Republican presidential candidate and the governor of our neighboring state of Ohio, John Kasich, said yesterday that on one of the Sunday talk shows that he can't understand why we don't put a coalition together, go there, and in his words, take care of this. Should there be boots on the ground? Is this what it's going to take to get ISIS away from us, away from Europe?
Well, we should remember one thing important at the beginning. We already have a coalition that's working on this. Another thing.
Do we?
Well, I mean, yeah, we do, actually.
It's coming together.
And it has. But here's the other point that I want to make, Paul. Look. We could take the coalition that we've been building over time. We could come together. And if we wanted to, if we were willing to commit tens of thousands of American combat troops in partnership with French, tens of thousands of French, and maybe some other countries would chip in a few thousand here or there, send tens of thousands of combat troops over to Iraq and Syria, we could probably largely defeat ISIS in its current form within a matter of months. But the question becomes, what happens the day after? Because there are larger issues in both Syria and Iraq here that fundamentally have to be dealt with. We've talked earlier about the Bashar al-Assad phenomenon, right? If we were to go into Syria and kick ISIS out of Raqqa and its other Syrian strongholds, and Bashar al-Assad is still in power, waging war on his citizens, what do we do about that? If we go into Iraq and similarly are able to somehow push ISIS out of Iraq, well, what do we do about the ongoing sectarian tensions and fighting among Iraqi politicians and people? How do we solve that? It's the same problem that we had after the most recent Iraqi war.
Okay, we've got less than 30 seconds, but with all the investments the U.S. has made in counterterrorism since 9/11, are we safer now? Is it harder for terrorists to carry out a Paris-style attack or a 9/11-style attack? I guess that's two different things. So as far as the 9/11 attacks, are we safer?
I believe we are. We've spent almost $700 billion since 9/11 on homeland security. We've come up with a number of innovations. I do believe we are safer today.
What about Paris? What about a Paris-style attack? Are we safer in that regard? Something smaller scale? Because this looks like this is the new threat.
Right. Safer, but are we completely safe? No, that's the reality.
University of Pittsburgh professor, Associate Professor of International Affairs is his official title, and he is a terrorism expert, a man who's been much in demand of late for obvious reasons, and we appreciate Michael Kenney making time for us here on Essential Pittsburgh, joining us in studio. Thank you very much, Dr. Kenney. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Coming up, the story of the radio station that's still relevant 30 years after going off the air. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.